apocalypse internet. Or not.
Yeah, yeah. Let's do it. I decided against the gin. I went for a whiskey.
All right.
Not that the not that any of the tunes that we have this week particularly want to make you cry, but anyway.
Oh, well. I haven't got anything to riff off that. I've been drinking Ballast Point Grunion, which is a pale ale that they make and put in cans and sell. So there's that.
I've gone off the pale ale a bit.
We did the I've gone off beer thing last week.
Yeah, I know, but just, I don't know, pale ale. Anyway.
This isn't bad. It's American hops, so they tend to be a bit more kind of bitter and resinous compared to the New Zealand ones. But it was worth the experiment.
Where do they grow hops in New Zealand? No, in New Zealand.
Oh, up around Machueka, which is like sort of just to the north. It's about half an hour from Nelson. It's basically my favourite part of – it's the best place in fucking New Zealand. It's just a brilliant part of the world. The coastline between Nelson and Machueka is just a lovely, lovely part of the world. And, you know, Machueka is also, if you go just the other side of Machueka, there's Kaitaracheri, which is probably one of the best beaches in New Zealand. It's just a gorgeous little beach. It's right next to Abel Tasman National Park.
I like that part. They grow a lot of hops
up there, and there's also a shitload of little craft breweries. Like, there's one that's literally on the highway in the middle of the hop fields called Hop Federation. They do a fucking amazing amazing pilsner and a really, really, really good IPA called Rakow, I think it is. Rakow? I'm trying to think what it's called. Named after one of the local rivers, I think.
I had one of the best bits of salmon I've ever eaten in my life up that way.
I'm not surprised.
Fantastic. Hot smoked ginger and shallots maybe. Hot smoked it in these sort of custom built sort of 44-gallon drums that they, you know, made into these hot smokers. Fuck, it was brilliant.
They do a lot of salmon in the in the hydro channels up in sort of central South Island, where we're we're planning to head up there on the weekend, up around Lake Tekapo, Twizel, Mount Cook, around there. A lot of the big canals they dug for the hydro scheme, they have salmon runs in them because they need fast moving water for a lot of what they do, and they just produce this fucking amazing salmon.
Well, one of the guys was telling me somewhere on the South Island, I can't remember, but they were fishing and they fish sort of just downstream of the salmon farms. And basically what the salmon eat is, you know, the high protein or whatever, the high energy food that gets fed into the salmon farms, but then also, you know, enough wild stuff that they develop a bit of flavor, you know, so they're these massively fat salmon that have this very, very diet that gives them, you know, fantastic flavor.
But they've just got a little bit of gaminess. Oh, that sounds like I need to get up there.
Mm.
And there's apparently a good craft brewery up around Twizel too, so I might have to check that out too.
I'd really like to come back to New Zealand and travel again. We were only there for 3 weeks last time, but
it never feels long enough. You could spend 3 weeks in the bottom half of the South Island and still not see everything.
Yeah.
You can spend in the bottom half of the South Island and not see everything.
Well, even the North Island, you know, we did a massive travel day and was just amazed at how much the landscape, you know, like I'm used to driving in Australia. Like I did quite a bit of travelling when I was a kid with my parents.
Yeah.
And, you know, we went from Adelaide.
You've got to drive for weeks to see different scenery. Like
like we went from Adelaide to the Northern Territory and
it's all the fucking same.
It's probably, you know, if you flew over it, it would probably be different. But if you're traveling for a whole day, the change is that gradual that you don't feel like anything's changed at all, which gives it a certain beauty. But
if you drive from, say, Dunedin to Queenstown, you'll see five distinctly different sort of environments just between there and between here and there, and it's only 280k.
I really want us to do a live podcast from Crankworx one year. I think that would be fucking. That would just be.
I'd settle for doing a live Crankworx from the fucking local pub.
Yeah, I just think, you know, go to Rotorua, wash the bikes.
We're not extreme enough. Extreme.
Look,
I made the stream.
You get out and watch, you know, watch the cars. It's not that different. It's just less noisy.
Yeah, but that's the point. The point of rallying is the noise and the spectacle and the risk of somebody fucking themselves up. I suppose that's the same.
But also seeing
amazing shit like old escorts and Audi Quattros and whatever else.
Mm.
And international superheroes turning up and flailing 1980s fucking rally cars around the place completely sideways. Because in a way that they can't do during their day job, because their day job they drive these massive, you know, all-wheel drive things that don't get anywhere near as leery. Otago Rally was last week, folks, in case you're wondering, and go and find it on my Instagrams. Some photos that were took from the spectator stage near the city, or maybe 20 minutes out of the city. But we're not here to talk about sport. We're here to talk about whatever the fuck it is we talk about in the After Dark. This is After Dark 133, and we are talking about three English bands. Well,
that means we've listened
to 266
new albums. That's fucking nuts.
Well, thereabouts. Yeah, we do 80 a year.
That's fucking insane when you think about it.
Yeah, and we still don't know what the fuck we're doing.
No, we definitely don't do that. But good music this week, I reckon.
I think there's three really interesting. I know it's all white guys from the British Isles or the islands of the British Isles.
Okay. So this is where my lack of research / you know, like just going in completely blind into an album, because I would have sworn that Dirty Photographs was like something from the south of America, where you would sit in a bar and drink bourbon and throw glasses at the band behind a cave.
Well, this is kind of a throwback. This is a callback to last week where we talked about this, because they're from the deep south of the UK, which is Northern Ireland, and they have a sound that feels very, very Delta Blues. Well, actually, what it really feels like is Akron, Ohio's own The Black Keys from 2001, 2002. That it really has a sense of the sound that they synthesized from the old blues masters in that, if you like, immediately, like the wave of bands that immediately followed the advent of the White Stripes.
It's funny because, you know, they had Coachella this week, and, you know, Beyonce sort of dominated it, which I'll get to later, but that sort of feels like her natural habitat. Like, If she has a natural habitat, walking into one of the biggest music festivals in the world and just fucking completely co-opting it to her own devices is exactly what I would expect her to do.
Yeah.
These guys I expect to be in the pubs I used to run, yeah, you know, where smoky, the tar is so thick on the fucking floor from the cigarettes that, you know, you can feel your shoes sticking to the floor, and the pool tables have been mended 50 fucking times. Yeah. And, you know, the glasses are ones that you could drop from 8 foot high and they're not going to break on the fucking ground.
But they'll break on someone's face.
Yeah, like, this is not this is not sort of the music that I would pick to put on if I was ever, you know, picking an album to put on just for my own enjoyment, but I enjoy this album. Yeah. It, and dirty is the right word for it. It is dirty music.
It's a dirty album. Well, this is the thing. I mean, the first note I wrote was that they're just doing early Black Keys, but I fucking love early Black Keys. So, this is very, very much my fucking areas. This is – the only possible chip I've got on this is that old mate's vocal wavers a little bit, particularly in the first track. He can't quite pull the notes that, say, Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys could have pulled. But I feel like in songwriting terms, they've got more range than the Black Keys had in their first couple of albums in the very early aughts. In terms of the Northern Ireland part, you have to go looking for it. But there are some songwriting influences on previous albums, probably more than this one, that trigger from their background, because they're from Lurgan, which is south of Belfast, which was part of the what they called the Murder Triangle in the Troubles. It was a hotspot for sectarian violence, and you can sort of see themes of that sort of stuff, almost like repurposed, like the Rebel Shrug. I kind of feel like is a song, which is probably, I think, probably the weakest song on the album, but it's a song that kind of alludes to the violence of the Troubles, but kind of more in kind of an old Western kind of context. And some of the songs on the previous album, like No Law in Lurgan and things like that, seem to be putting the violence of the Troubles into the context of say, the Wild West, which is an interesting way to talk about it. I mean, it must be really hard to make music about the Troubles when you're from somewhere where the people around you have engaged in the violence, or have descended from people who were killed and who killed others.
It would be hard to find someone that wasn't affected emotionally or physically in some way. Yeah. However, I was just thinking about, I'm sure Ireland has a lot of the sort of bars that we just said would be perfect for this sort of music. Yeah. So maybe they've got a natural, fertile breeding ground for this sort of music to flourish.
Well, I'll find out in a few months, because it looks like we might be popping over to have a quick look at Dublin.
Nice.
I might have two travelling companions that'll stop me going to, say, the Temple Bar and seeing whether Bono and the Edge are in town. But yeah, it's dirty, fucked up punk blues, and it's exactly my jam. I really like their sound. This is like their third or fourth album, and their previous albums are of a type like this, but I feel like this is certainly their strongest. So cool. And in case nobody picked up the reference that I dropped on the Twitter, Bob Logged the Fourth mentioned that he'd played this album at work and it had lit up the entire warehouse. They reckon that it had been well received there, and I sort of retweeted that for the pod account, saying, Bonneville Triumph, because the Bonneville is a model of Triumph motorcycle that won the.
I did not get that reference.
The thing about Northern Ireland is that it's a real hotbed for motorcycle road racing, you know, like Isle of Man TT style stuff. The only place you can do that legally is basically on the Isle of Man or in Northern Ireland. For some reason, it wasn't allowed in mainland England or Scotland, but it was allowed in Northern Ireland and the Isle of Man. So they have this sort of circuit of road races, like the Northwest 200 and the Ulster Grand Prix and things like that. So riding very fast motorcycles and crashing off them and killing yourself is a real theme that runs through Northern Ireland culture.
So what did you think of Holy Doom?
I think of Holy Doom by D-Mob Happy. was that it's my favourite album of the year so far. I fucking love the shit out of it.
Wow.
I adored it. It's sort of, and I said last week, and I sort of realised this while I was listening to last week's episode and show noting it, that it was kind of, it felt a bit early Queens of the Stone Age-y. And I don't think Queens of the Stone Age-y is really a genre because it covers so much stuff, but this has such a fucking feel of early Queens of the Stone Age. It's all sort of super fucked up and sleazy, and some of the songs just strut along like a fucking nightcrawler. But it also has this interesting elements of kind of almost the good parts of late Beatles.
Well, I was gonna say that the first two songs, I was like, what the fuck is, you know, is Adam H. Photo writing music on the side here? This is totally fucking Beatles tribute music.
No, man, but the Beatles never had this strut. You could
definitely feel the Beatles thing. And I was like, okay, well, I actually enjoyed the first two songs, but I was like, I'm not going to want a whole album of this. And then it flipped. If you go into Maker of Mine, it's not that aesthetic.
No,
it's completely fucking different.
Some of the louder, angrier tracks off Rated R.
Yeah. It's and like it was definitely the back end of the album that I liked a lot more.
Yeah, well, I Be Your Man, which is the second track of the album. It's got such a filthy strut to it. It's like the
fucking Beatles have, you know, coked up and gone out on the town with some big electric guitars, isn't it?
It's like Beatles went out in the town with Josh Homme and the rest of Queens of the Stone Age. It's a bit like that Them Crooked Vultures album, which we picked as a classic a while ago. And I obviously think it's a classic because I picked it. I know you weren't quite as keen on it, but the best parts of that album remind me of this. This is their second album. Their first is a little bit more kind of Nevermindy. It's a bit more kind of thrashy, grungy stuff, but it's also good. Apart from the lead single off it, which called Succubus, which also has this kind of sort of swagger and strut and clearly drug fueled, sex flavored rock and roll. I'm a big fucking fan. There's one track that actually feels like it's pulling ideas from the Beach Boys. Fake Satan, I think it is. It's the climbing harmonies and the way they're playing around with it. It's like a super fucked up version of the Beach Boys, which I'm totally in for. So, yeah, I really, really fucking enjoyed this album.
They were a little bit like obviously not like musically. That's a terrible fucking sentence, isn't it?
No, I get what you mean.
But in terms of ambition. Hey, we really like this, so we're going to incorporate a bit of that into this song, and like they're not scared of showing their work. It's like, oh, we don't have to hide it. It's like, no, we really fucking like this sound.
Yeah.
So we're going to play that sound, but we're going to play it our way.
Yeah, with a song like "Be Your Man," they're definitely trying a lot of. They're trying to pull a whole lot of ambitiously trying to pull a whole lot of themes together. But because they land it, you forgive them for, you know, sort of saying, "Well, that feels like Sergeant, like a harmony of Sergeant Pepper's, the good parts of Sergeant Pepper's." But they've got such a fucking amazing depth and groove behind it. It flies. It works.
Yeah.
So, shouts to D-Mob Happy. This kind of feels like what Raw Blood's second album should have been. I know that it's not really it's not exactly what they do, but there's a similarity in sort of some sorts of elements of tone, certainly of guitar tone, that they probably could have pulled off. But shouts to them.
So, before we get on to the classic album, I've got a little story for you.
Got a story to tell?
So, Catch from Resin Dogs, who I'm friends with on Facebook, was posting, I don't know, it's always one of those, you know, 10 albums that influenced you, or I don't know, one of those Facebooky things. But, you know, being Catch, it's a super, super fucking interesting list because, you know, he's doing a little 2-paragraph blurb about why this album was cool or what got them onto him. And
it's almost using Facebook like a blog.
Yeah, like a mini blog. So my favorite live show is the Stereo MCs from the September 11 Livid. And he posted up their first album and said, you know, really like these guys, we're always into them. Dave and I convinced the organizers of Livid to bring them out for 2011. I just went, mate, you have my eternal thanks for that. So, yeah, I thought it was pretty cool that the Resin Dogs got into the ears of the organizers of Livid and said, you've got to bring these guys out. They got a new album. Bring them out. And, you know, a weird sort of confluence of influences of Brisbane music scene that turned into my, you know, favourite live gig of all time.
I thought your favourite live gig of all time was when you had to pay Salmonella Dub and Fat Freddy's with a carton of beer to make them fuck off. So that you didn't get
that's definitely my favourite night. But in terms of my, you know, things that I went and saw as a...
You didn't have to put on.
Yeah.
I did a blog post back when blogs were a thing about my favourite live gigs and my favourite festivals, which is kind of two different things. I think, pretty sure the Black Keys at the Zoo were one of my favourite live gigs. And again, that just to hark back to the Bonnevilles, that's kind of the space I would, you know, you could see them in. I mean, the Zoo's quite a bit bigger than I'm sure some of these little hole-in-the-wall clubs are, but that is very much the kind of space you'd expect to see them. Dear Mob Happy would be a fucking amazing festival band. Everyone's off their fucking chops and dancing like absolute mentalists.
Well, before we hit Disraeli Gris, should we talk about the Beyonce Coachella thing?
Well, yeah.
Because
she had no competition. If you have a look at the Coachella lineup, it was fucking pants. But I guess they spent all their money very wisely on the biggest pop star in the world.
What made me cry is there is actually a band I really want to see live on at the same time, and I wouldn't have gone and seen them. I think I would have gone and seen Beyonce because...
Well, I actually thought about watching the live stream to see the band that I wanted to see, which it probably wasn't the same band, but wasn't Highly Suspect, was it?
No,
I feel bad for all the bands who are up against it. I think David Byrne was scheduled against Beyonce.
Fuck.
I guess
you
may find yourself
that pulls a certain niche that's probably not into Beyonce. But I we've talked quite a bit about how one of the great things about listening and being interested in music now is that it's really easy to get into a niche. Like if you've got a niche of music you like, it's fully accessible. It's not hard to find. It's not hard to form a community about it. It's not hard to talk about it, which sort of kills the big, massive pop star. And that's borne out by the fact that, you know, the really big pop stars don't sell anywhere near the amount of records that the, you know, the Beatles or Michael Jackson or any of those guys sold, because there's more choice and it's easier for people not to have to purchase that sort of stuff. So the fact that she just dominated everything in terms of the mind space, like
Twitter. I mean, not just
Twitter, Facebook as well. But
just Twitter a week later.
I had people at work mention it. I guess what I'm saying is, if you're even slightly interested in music, you knew about what had just happened. And the fact that it wasn't just she went to Coachella and did a set. It's like, no, she went to Coachella and sort of went all out in a I always laugh with Vanessa because we talk about-
It was a bigger show than a fucking Super Bowl show.
Yeah, that's right.
That's also because she probably had creative control, but-
Yeah. But also, it's the mindset. It's the mindset to walk into somewhere like Coachella and go, yeah, I'm not just going to do a show. I'm going to smash this show. I just don't know how many people could do that these days. Like,
well, Tay Tay couldn't, and that's kind of the comparison. Is Tay Tay?
No, I don't think so.
The biggest pop artist, Tay Tay, or her, and apparently, you know, Tay Tay sells. And, you know, there are lots of people voted for Trump. You know, there's lots of people who listen to Tay Tay. But, and we're not saying that all Tay Tay voters are Trump, all Trump voters are Tay Tay voters as well. But it's a pretty tight Venn diagram.
I think Foo Fighters would be the biggest.
I reckon 10 years ago, for sure.
Rock band left. Like, I can't think of anyone else. I just don't know
new rock bands left who would be like that. There's no rock band who are at the peak of their powers right now.
No.
In the same way that, say, you know, U2 would have been, say, 30 years ago, or the Foo Fighters would have been, say, 10 or 20 years ago. 20 years ago, really. I suppose the Foo Fighters maybe 15 years ago in sort of the early aughts.
I just don't know who could. And the thing was, like, admittedly, like you said, it's a Twitter thing, but.
And we, I mean, let's face it, we follow a lot of NBA Twitter, which means a lot of black people.
Yeah, yeah.
It was really important to them because it was heavily themed around HBCUs, historically black, and coloured universities, as I understand it. They had, like, marching bands from you know, black.
But I also follow sort of sci-fi nerdy Twitter and tech Twitter. You know, like, I follow a couple of other sort of more, I don't know. I don't think they're less mainstream. They're a different face base. But what I found was amazing was, you know, I normally have clear delineation lines, you know, this is basketball Twitter, this is tech Twitter, this is pop culture Twitter, this is Australian Twitter. And it was just everywhere. It just cut across my whole feed.
It quickly becomes across everyone Twitter. You know, there'll be things where everyone wants to put an oar in on Twitter.
I've never seen it cut across everything like that did before.
Yeah, but you know why it was? Because it was on the internet for free. And so everyone
could possibly. Yeah, which is really good marketing for them because they sell out anyway. They're making their money. Yeah. It's
and
not
their money
like they're
is
losing.
Used to fund anti-gay and bisexual and transgender campaigns,
I did point out to a mate of mine who'd been to Coachella. I was like, "You realise that your money went to this?" And he's like, "No, I did not." I was like, "Yeah, I know you're probably not going to go back, but you should probably check that out."
Yeah, I mean that's the thing in the back of your head that makes you go, "Oh, this is all great."
Yeah,
but
yeah, that's right. Coachella
massive shitlords.
Yeah, but the funny thing, that was the other thing that sort of interested me was that it was not Beyonce's performance at Coachella. It was just Coachella sort of faded into the background. You know, oh, hey, did you know there was other music on at the same time for a whole? No, it was Beyonce's performance.
Yeah, but if you look at the lineup. There really wasn't. It was a fucking.
Oh, really? It was weak.
Because normally, I mean, last couple of Coachellas, you know, I look at it and go, "Oh yeah, yeah, they're good. They're good. They're good. They're good. They're good." No, it was just Beyonce. So,
yeah. See, the thing is that we've listened to so much interesting stuff and so much that now those huge festivals, I look at them and go, oh, there's like 9 bands that I want to go and see.
Well, normally, I mean, like Primavera Sound that Red Bull always cover. I've always got heaps and heaps and heaps of bands that you think, fuck yeah. But the Coachella lineup was just toilet, except for Beyonce. So I'm not saying that they ran dead for her or anything. Well, they spent all their money on her and couldn't afford anybody else, but they just weren't – there wasn't anything else that really – did anything. So, but not taking anything. And it's also a weird festival in that they're all turning up again this week to have another crack.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
You can
it's
watch
like
Beyonce again. I presume they'll be live streaming it a second time.
I don't know. It's usually a completely different show, isn't it? The second weekend?
No, it's usually the same artist doing the same thing. I don't think they live stream it the second week. I think because it would be, they've kind of already done it.
I'm just having a look at the at who else I would have liked to have seen. Yeah, I don't think I would have seen David Byrne. It's always interesting looking at these modern lists and going, oh yeah, we've reviewed that band. They're shit. I wouldn't go and see them.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many of them you just go rubbish.
Jungle was the band that I really would have liked to have seen that was on at the same time as Beyonce.
Yeah, they're not streaming the second weekend. But the second weekend, I believe, has the same lineup.
Yeah, it's really not as many. Like you said, the last couple of years, we've sort of gone through, oh, Soul Wax were there. I would have liked to have seen
that.
Soul
I mean, Wax. It was nice that Tash Sultana got a gig and Pants Joy less so because he's a knob. But it's felt like a more hip hop and R&B themed audience than in previous years.
And I wonder whether if you're going to get Beyonce there, whether you want to make sure that you surround her with more R&B acts to keep the crowd in, you know, happy for the rest of the festival.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I mean, they had like Cardi B, French Montana, fucking. You know, there's lots of the Migos and fucking Vince Staples and Tyler the Creator and The Weeknd and, yeah, Portugal the Man. Post Malone is just a shit white rapper. You know, it's there wasn't anything there that made me think, oh, fuck, I need to see them.
All right. Shall we talk about some very, very old music?
Should we talk about some 1967? Because we've talked about Sgt. Pepper's and we've talked about Hendrix. Should we talk about another album from 1967? Disraeli Gears by Cream. Second album, their second last album.
So, the thing with Cream was like I'd always had it in my head that they were like one of the first supergroups.
Yeah, they were because Clapton was with the Yardbirds and left, you know, to join Cream.
I'd never heard of the other two guys in Cream.
Yeah, but
when I actually in 1967, yeah. But I just assumed that it was like, you know, Clapton and someone from Led Zepp and someone from, you know, something else, but not. Yeah, I guess in period it was a supergroup, but not in terms of longevity, I guess.
I don't remember the backstory of Cream in terms of where they, you know, how they joined up and where they came from and what bands they were in previously. Obviously, Clapton was in the Yardbirds and then he went on to be in, you know, Derek and the Dominoes, which was basically his project, and then did his own things. But, I mean, I thought, you know, my recollection of them was that they were more, and you look at the album cover and it is pure psychedelia. And you think this is going to be the most psychedelic album in the history of psychedelia. It's going to make Jimi Hendrix look like a fucking a day at the bowls club.
Nah, it's not.
And
that.
It's not really. You know, it's relatively. And there's a couple of tracks that trip off into some fun areas, but it's relatively conventional.
It's very enjoyable,
in terms
though.
Of its non singles. I mean, the singles I think we can just take as read are fucking bulletproof. They're like Sunshine of Your Love and
Strange Brew.
Yeah, Strange Brew, Swalaber, fucking Tales of Brave Ulysses, which is a tremendous song because it's it has all these delusions of fucking of like literature kind of poetry. But in reality, it's a song about a hot chick on the beach, which is hilarious. Have all this fucking this ancient Greek mysticism, but it's really just a hot chick in a bikini at the beach in Greece.
But I just found it incredibly solid. I just there was not other than the little comedy song at the end.
Yeah, the skiffle group kind of fucking
you know,
barrel of monkeys kind of rubbish at the end.
Yeah, sort of Monty Python-esque attempt at you doing a skit.
I think that's like an old Cockney, you know, like Knees Up Mother Brown sort of song.
Mm. Well, look, DJ Format has on the end of Ill Culinary Behaviour has a very similar sort of Cockney little ditty at the end of it. So maybe it's, you know, it's just a bit of a British tradition.
Yeah.
You know, throwing that song in. But I never felt like the album flat. This is such a strong album from start to finish. It just doesn't really dip down that much. That's in my estimation.
I was literally about to say that the non-single tracks on it are weak and weaker than I remembered.
I enjoyed the way they played their instruments, the tightness of it, the
three of them were amazing together. And I reckon Ginger Baker's drumming is super underrated. It's kind of it's almost like an evolutionary precursor of what John Bonham did with Led Zeppelin in terms of how hard he hit the kit and how they mic'd him up. There's the bones of heavy metal are sitting right there for to be developed into.
The other thought I had, and I have no idea, and I should probably go and do a bit of half-assed internet research, but
I would say quarter-assed.
I really feel like this album influenced Knopfler from Dire Straits a lot, just in the way the songs are put together and the way the guitars played. It's not the same at all, but I can just, I don't know, I can see little flourishes and stuff that show up later in Dire Straits music. And I know Dire
Straits, the way Clapton played, that's entirely possible.
And just not even the way that Clapton played the guitar, but even in the way that some of the how it fits together. Like, obviously, Dire Straits, especially earlier on, was a little bit slower and a bit more, I don't know, a bit more bluesy, I guess, those really early albums. And his voice is completely different to this sort of vocal. But, yeah, I really enjoyed this album. Fuck, I listened to it like 4 or 5 times. And I've got no, other than Sunshine of Your Love, like, I've heard Strange Brew, but Hendrix covered that, didn't he?
I don't know Strange Brew. He covered Sunshine of Your Love. We dropped the link into the last week's show notes of him playing a fucked up double speed cover of Sunshine of Your Love when the band broke up. And that managed to get Jimi Hendrix thrown off the BBC for good because he... because he did it live on television when they were trying to wind him up. And the host was supposed to come on and sing a duet with them, and then he decided not to play the song at all that they were supposed to be playing. But they were all contemporaries. So, you know, they all jammed together and played together and stuff.
Oh, maybe it's a lot. Like, I've got in my head a different sounding version of Strange Brew that I'm used to. That album version sounded different to what I was used to, so yeah. I don't know where this is the thing where I grew up in a house where I didn't really have any of this late 60s, early 70s music from my parents.
Oh, nor I. I discovered this. I had to go out and find this shit myself. Although when I did discover it, my old man said that he. This was one of the last out because he eventually he got into classical music and went away from pop and rock completely. But he was quite partial to this band and this album, particularly Tales of Brave Ulysses because of the fact it had more interesting lyrics than a lot of those songs of the era. But I think he once told me that when he was going in to buy a tie for his wedding in 1971, the shop was playing this album. He had a really clear recollection of it.
Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I think it is a classic. Like you said, yeah. Maybe it seems a lot more conventional now because of what's come from it.
Well, I've never listened to it in the direct competition, if you like, to Are You Experienced? And having listened to that only a couple of weeks ago, it felt like the kind of ballady pop based songs that Hendrix managed to land so effectively. He managed to infuse with a lot more interest in life than they deserve to have. Some of them on this album just don't quite work. Like Dance the Night Away. Dance the Night Away? Or is that, that's a Led Zeppelin song. That's a fucking Van Halen song. They don't land quite as well as they could, but the best songs on this album are fucking blistering. They're really, really great. I mean, I would say Sunshine of Your Love is as close to a perfect rock pop song of the genre and of the era that you'll ever find. It's just so perfectly conceived and landed.
Strange Brew is my favorite song on the album.
It's also a cracking song.
Yeah.
But when I was growing up, I got like early teenager, I got right into, you know, blues. So particularly, you know, this era of blues, which is, you know, the blues influenced kind of late 60s power trio kind of bands. So this is definitely my areas.
So we've been doing this long enough now that we're starting to get bands that we've listened to albums before that we've liked releasing new music. So one of my new albums this week is Stonefield's Far From Earth.
Far From Earth.
It's
a sort of a methane explosion.
In typical Bezo fashion, I can't remember what Stonefield were like.
Yeah, I can. They're a bunch of sisters. I think they're a Triple J Unearthed band, and they kind of do sort of cross between Led Zeppy prog and kind of Fleetwood Mac-y yacht rock from recollection. Very plaintive female vocal. I remember them being decent. So they've got a new album out.
Yeah, so we'll see how that goes. And then one of the artists that I sort of was around when I was doing the live stuff was Catalyst. Amazing producer, terrible live performer.
Because all he did was plug in his laptop and press play.
Well, you would think so. You would think that it would be hard to be a bad live performer, but yet he was. But he does a sort of funk project with a vocalist called Space Invaders, and he's got a new album called Wild World. So let's have a listen to that as well.
That's good. We've got a couple of Australian acts.
Yeah.
After being very British Isles infused last week.
I don't think I'm going to enjoy it as much as Catalyst, but I thought,
some of Catalyst stuff was really good. I mean, Up Rock This was a really
yeah, like that.
But then it had a fantastic video clip too.
That Catalyst album is, I don't think it's on Spotify, which is the only reason I haven't done it as a classic.
No, we struggled to find it, didn't we? We could only find like a live cover or something. It didn't work out at all. Maybe it might have subsequently popped up there because, you know, we probably haven't looked for a while.
And the if we do it, the thing is that he also farmed the songs out to a whole bunch of Australian producers, like Daniel Sand from Coolism, you know, and basically gave them all the parts of the songs, you know, not just the song and said, here, remix it. It's like, you know, here's all the layers of the tracks that I did to build this song, you know, pull it apart and put it back together whichever way you like. And so I think the original album was called Manipulating Agent, and then the remix album was called Agent Manipulated.
Yeah.
And that was almost as interesting as good, just to see, you know, what all the raw ingredients. It was almost like, you know, two chefs with two.
It sounds like Iron Chef or something, where you've got all the same ingredients to see what you can make.
Yeah, pull it apart and put it back together and see what you can do with it. So, that, you know, I don't think it was as solid as an album, but it was fascinating to
in the
to
context
see what
of the album
do.
It came from, you know, it's more interesting in that context.
Hmm. So, what have you got for a classic for me, mate?
I'm going to go with a band, which is a surprise because I always tend to go with a band. I took a photo on the road.
Not a solo vocalist, not a singer-songrowriter?
No, not the singer-songwriter blues. Thanks very much, Tim Rogers. I took a photo of some road and put it on Instagram earlier in the week, and the road said pedestrian, and I said DCS3 was better. And, of course, that was a Grinspoon reference, and the internet got it, which was lovely. But then immediately when I looked on Instagram, immediately below that was a Phil Jamieson from Grinspoon, of course, writers of Pedestrian and Dead Cat Times 3, and he was getting ready to appear in the Green Day musical for American Idiot. And it reminded me that Green Day made American Idiot, which is a fucking terrible album and a ridiculously self-indulgent load of pap. But it also reminded me that Green Day recorded Dookie, which is a very, very good album from 1994. I think it broke an entire, it broke punk rock to an entirely new generation of kids. So the classic album for this week will be Green Day's Dookie.
Interesting. Not an album I was a massive fan of in period.
Whenever I go back to it, I mean, I always think, oh, you know, I know those tracks really well, and I've had friends in cover bands who've played the ass out of it. Thanks. G'day, Adam. But whenever I go back and listen to it, I'm reminded, no, these guys really nailed it the first time. And nothing they did subsequently was ever quite as crisply, you know, conceived and delivered upon as Dookie was. It was just... There's quite a fury and a power behind it. It's that works. That's exactly what you want for punk rock.
I've got an idea for an episode, you know, sometime deep in the future about bands that do just the Lightning in the Bottle album. You know, they might have a long career, and they might produce other albums that have the occasional good track on them, but they just produce this one album that's just almost perfect. And then, you know, you're always listening to their next release because you're just hoping that they can replicate it, but they never do. And you go back and listen to the back catalogue and it's like they haven't got their shit together. You know, there's the occasional – you can see where it's coming. Yeah. But then – and then you get bands like Stereo MCs, like who did Deep Down and Dirty, and it was such a radical departure from what they've been doing before – and got absolutely panned in the British music press that they went away from it. They never went back to that style. They went back to their sort of their original style that got them, you know, big money when they did songs like Connected. And they never went back to that sort of grittier, grimier style. And I've just left with this album that's on an island and it's like, I just want more of this, but they're just never going to do it because – you know, wasn't making the money.
Is it? Do you really want more of that though? Because then you end up with just
another copy of the same album with slightly different lyrics. It waters it down. Do you think?
Yeah, I think it does. You know, I was thinking about that when I was listening to the Bonnevilles, thinking, okay, this is, you know, this feels like the Black Keys could have recorded this in 2002 as a companion piece to Thick Freakness. It very, very, very easily could have been. Now, is that good or bad?
Yeah.
Is it bad that it's the same thing as before as you've loved? Or is it a good thing that in 2018 somebody is making this awesome fucking music that you fucking loved in 2002 and it's not the same band and they've never met each other and it's just like it's just they're continuing on like a baton, like a torch has been passed from the blues masters who inspired, you know, the bands of the 60s and 70s who inspired, you know, the Black Keys, who inspired, these sorts of guys. It's sort of a self-replicating thing.
We should be thankful of bands that can produce one more than one album that you would class as a classic or class as something that you really enjoy listening to. Like Salmonella Dub and Fat Freddy's Drop. Like I still go back to those classic albums that we recorded for those two bands, and like, you know, Boats is an obvious choice, but man,
what was the Salmonella? It was Killervision, wasn't it? The Salmonella Dub album.
I think I did go with Killervision, but you know,
it's a long time ago. It was a 15, I think. It was a long time.
But like, I really struggled to go Killervision or Inside the Dub Plates. You know, another week and I would have flipped my I think I have to do Boats for Fat Freddy's because it's like their
Template album for everything that followed.
But fuck, Blackbirds is a good album. It's a really, really good album that's only gotten better the more I've listened to it.
I mean, at some point, we're going to run out of classic albums. We're going to have to go back and do like the second best album by every band that we've already done.
The thing is, though, like, you know, we sort of every time we talk about a band, we don't just talk about the classic. You have to put context around them and you know.
There's also like, some bands for whom we've just copped out and done a live album, like AC/DC. When we did it right off the top of the bat, I just did the live album. But in hindsight, I mean, that was very, very early in the process. And I mean, that was because it was the album I've played the most in my entire life. But if you wanted to go and pick an AC/DC classic studio album, that's a more interesting discussion because a lot of them have got their own, although, you know, they're renowned as a band who's recorded the same album 27 times. Each one of them has its own kind of fingerprint. And it's interesting trying to pick between them.
Or you get Hunters and Collectors, which all their studio stuff is massively flawed, terrible.
Because it's thin, like, and reedy and under-miked and underproduced.
The vocal is so high in the mix and, you know, they've got this massive fucking awesome horn and rhythm section that they just doesn't even show up on their studio albums. And then you listen to them as a live band and they're just this powerful beast that just, you know, can't be restrained. It just always baffles me. I went back actually the other day a while ago. I went back and listened to like 5 Hunters and Collectors studio albums in a row. And occasionally they nail a song, but like even the songs that I like, I'm just like, where's this? Where's this in the mix? Why am I not hearing this part? This is the best part of the song and you fucking got it, you know. You almost want to go and steal all the master tapes and hand them to a decent producer and go, hey, can you fucking make this?
I think that's an 80s thing too because I know that the 80s, like the Angels, for example, they did a live album in 87. And it's better than anything they recorded up to that in any studio, even though they'd had some massive hits through the 70s and 80s, just because in the live version, the sound is so fucking huge, you know, by comparison. Might just be the fact that they've just got so many fucking Marshall stacks and they're playing so fucking loud and it's just gives the songs so much more depth and urgency and resonance. But it's just not there in the studio versions, which always sound kind of thin and reedy.
Yeah. I can remember, you know, being at the Alex Hotel you know, and that, it was like being shot in the chest, the wall of sound that came from that, the brass and the bass guitar from that little riff, and it was just holy shit, and that just doesn't come through in the studio recording. You know, it's like this tinny little fucking beep melody. You know,
someone playing along.
Might as well be played on a fucking, you know, Casio keyboard. Anyway, I don't know how we got onto that, but it was a nice little digression.
Well, we can get off it because I think we're done. This was the Out of the Dark. We're going to catch you next week.
See you, folks.